Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. For much of her life, Margarita Gokun-Silver dealt with headaches, mostly run-of-the-mill stress headaches, treatable with over-the-counter painkillers. She outgrew her 20s, and things changed.
I think I was about maybe in my late 30s when I started getting really bad migraines. I went out to lunch with my daughter, and it just suddenly appeared. It just came with such intensity that I barely made it home from lunch. I drove as fast as I could, ran upstairs, and I just threw up everything.
The pain cut Margarita down. She couldn't get out of bed for 7 hours. And when she reached for that bottle of ibuprofen, it did nothing.
I think it felt like a train, maybe. It usually feels like a lot of pressure right around my eyebrows and around my temples. And it's just as if somebody is just squeezing and pressing on those areas really, really hard. And all of that begins resonating in the back of my head. So from then on, it was just years and years of trying to figure out what can help. And they were coming quite often, although whenever I've seen doctors, they would be like, oh, well, every 2 weeks, that's not too bad. And I was like, huh, pretty bad every 2 weeks if you were out of commission for 3 days, because my migraines would last about 3 days.
So she did know she was experiencing migraines, but Margarita never got a clear diagnosis for why she was suddenly experiencing these headaches. But doctors did not hesitate to offer her possible treatments.
I know when I started going to doctors, you know, people would throw medications at me, or one time I tried Botox, just basically try to maybe prescribe a pill that would prevent it. You know, every medication at some point would either stop working or give me terrible rebounds. The headache would come back much worse.
So after several failed attempts, Margarita tried acupuncture.
You know, I think I went to an acupuncturist for, I want to say 6 months, and it did help. They started spacing out my migraines, and they lasted a little less. So I continuously go back to acupuncture. I haven't done it in a while, but at this point, my migraines are a little better. They don't come as often. So I am able to manage them just basically, I guess, giving myself a rest for 1 or 2 days and using cold compresses that really helps on my head and just, you know, trying to keep away from the screens, as I said. But if it gets worse, then yeah, I'm definitely going back to acupuncture.
So Margarita found some solutions that mostly work for her, but the solutions don't answer the questions she still has. Why did the headaches come on so suddenly? Why did so many medications not work for her? And why was acupuncture working?
I mean, no doctor has told me. Acupuncturists obviously tell me that that's been proven to help. But as far as cold compresses, it just feels good. It's kind of, I feel what I need at the moment. And you may laugh, but for me, for example, is cans of some beverage, Coke or beer or anything. If you put in the refrigerator, they have the right amount of coldness when you apply it to that area of their eyebrows, and it just helps.
That's Margarita Gokun-Silver. She's a writer and author of I Named My Dog Pushkin and Other Immigrant Tales, and she's based in Oxford, England. Now, if Margarita's experience sounds familiar, even down to pressing that cold can of Coca-Cola against your forehead, that's because it's incredibly common. New research finds that over 52% of the world's population, more than half, experienced a headache disorder in just the past year, and that's half of all of humanity. An awful lot of people suffering with a disorder that science still knows so little about. And don't you kind of want to know why? Well, we do. So that's why today we're turning to Dr. Amal Starling, a neurologist at the Mayo Clinic. She joins us from Tempe, Arizona. Dr. Starling, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a good day when we get to talk about migraine.
You may be one of the few people who gets to say that authentically here, Dr. Starling, but I hear you, and you know about this personally, right? You have a story with struggling with recurrent severe headaches. Is that not right?
I do. It's very personal to me because I had some visual symptoms with my head pain, and so I did fortunately receive a diagnosis quickly when I was in college. However, similar to the patient who was just speaking, I wasn't necessarily offered a lot of great options. I was just told I was too stressed out, I needed to get some massages, I needed to not be a double major, and I basically was like, I'm in college, I don't have money to be able to get massages, I want to do a double major. So I just took over-the-counter medications. And similar to the patient again, some of those over-the-counter medications started causing rebound headaches for me, but I didn't know. And since the first doctor didn't offer me anything, I didn't go back. And it wasn't until medical school when I was learning about migraine that I was like, oh, there are other options.
Well, we're really glad to have you today because anytime there's a study or a body of research that finds that an overwhelming number or at least so many people are suffering from something that we don't understand a lot about, we want to know why. So, but first of all, this new research that finds that more than half of all people on the planet experienced some kind of headache disorder in the past year. First of all, Dr. Starling, does that number make sense to you? Because it does seem massive to me.
It does make sense to me because there are multiple types of headache disorders, and one of the most common ones is what we call tension-type headache. Now, that's not what I commonly see in my clinic. That's a more mild to moderate headache. If someone needs to take something, they might take something over the counter. It doesn't impair their day-to-day function. What I see in my clinic and what really leads to migraine being one of the leading causes of disability worldwide is migraine disease. This is a genetic neurologic disease. There are environmental factors that can contribute to it. But it is also very common. 1 in 5 women, 1 in 16 men, 1 in 11 children are affected by migraine.
Wow. Okay. But so when we're talking about headache disorders, and again, this huge number of half the world's population last year saying they suffered from some kind of disorder, it seems to be a broad definition.
It is. So a lot of people will, ask me to do a talk about headaches. And that's like asking someone to do a talk about fever. Headache is a symptom. It's not a diagnosis. It is a symptom of a variety of neurologic disorders. The one that is the most disabling and the one that I see in my clinic is migraine.
Understood. Okay. So that makes sense because that 3.5 billion people saying that they suffered from a headache disorder is an eye-catching headline. But it makes more sense now when we're talking about a broader definition. So we will focus on the severe end of the scale, Dr. Starling, the migraine end as you're talking about. But if we use the phrase headache disorder for what are much more common, maybe stress headaches, tension headaches, the kind of thing that, you know, there's 8 zillion ads on TV for various over-the-counter drugs for. I mean, should we be concerned about that end of the scale, too? Because that, to me, seems like almost like a normal part of life.
We should still be concerned about it because most of those individuals who are seeking care for their quote-unquote stress headache or sinus headache or tension headache probably have migraine, and they're being misdiagnosed and undertreated, and it's adding to the disability of migraine. Because if someone really had a stress headache, tension-type headache, they're likely not seeking treatment because it's not impairing their day-to-day life. If it's resulting in impairment of function, it is more than likely migraine that is not diagnosed and thus undertreated.
Okay. So how much would you say that we, being science, knows about What causes headache disorders?
We know a lot more than we did before. The science has been evolving. It used to be thought that it was related directly to blood vessels, and that's why you get this pounding pain, because you can feel your blood vessels. Interestingly, there was a study that looked at the frequency of that pulsation that people feel, and they found that it is not aligned with your actual blood flow or your pulse. And now we also know that migraine is not as much related to a blood vessel disorder. It's not a vascular disorder, but rather it is a disorder of abnormal brain function. And we know the different parts of the brain that are involved and the different targets or the different proteins that might be involved in migraine, but we still have a lot more to learn. One of the key things to remember is that migraine does have genetic factors, but it's not one gene or one genetic mutation, but they've identified many different genes and genetic mutations that might contribute to migraine vulnerability. But here's the kicker. Different people have a different combination of these genetic mutations. So not everyone's migraine disease is exactly the same as the next person's. So the symptoms can be a little bit different, and also the treatment can be a little bit different. So we do have good treatment options for a subset of patients with migraine, but we still have to advance our scientific knowledge and our treatment for the other subsets that we still haven't been able to treat appropriately.
Okay. Now, we've got 30 seconds before our first break, Dr. Starling. Could you tell me what happened with you and your experience with a severe headache disorders? Did you eventually find a way to get it under control?
I did. I was able to find as-needed rescue medications, and those are the medications you take when you have a migraine attack. And there have been periods of my life, migraine fluctuates throughout life, where I've had an increased frequency of attacks, and I've needed to prevent or reduce the frequency, and that required a daily medication for a period of time. And so I've been able to figure out how to live my life with the diagnosis of migraine, and that's my goal for all my patients.
Well, we are talking this hour, about the widespread prevalence of severe headache disorders and why science has so much farther to go to understand what's really driving it in the brains of many millions of individuals. So we'll have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the widespread prevalence of severe headache disorders. There was new research recently that found that more than 50% of people worldwide have experienced a headache disorder in the past year, and this is a result of researchers trawling through more than 300 scientific publications on headaches and amassing that information and coming up with this conclusion. So the question we're asking is, if there indeed are so many people around the world, including here in the United States, who are suffering from headache disorders, why is there such a big gap between that and how much science understands and even how much headache science is being funded. I'm joined today by Dr. Amal J. Starling. She's associate professor of neurology at the Mayo Clinic, who studies primary and secondary headache disorders, including migraines and post-traumatic headaches. Dr. Starling, one just more quick question about this finding, this sort of like meta finding here that I keep referring back to. Just from your sort of professional opinion, do you think that the pandemic had anything to do with it? Because the researchers were looking at papers published over the past year, and the entire world has been in the grips of an historic event.
I do think the pandemic has likely had a contributing factor. I think that what we've been seeing in clinic, as well as what we've seen in some of the literature, it's early and there will be more literature that comes out over the next several years, is that individuals who developed COVID-19, who contracted COVID-19, they had a headache at the time of the infection. But many of these individuals, even after the infection has resolved and they no longer have the virus in their body, maybe weeks or even months later, they may have a residual or persistent headache. So like a new onset of a headache disorder that was triggered by the infection. Or they may have had a headache disorder before, but it was like very mild and insignificant, infrequent. And now after they had COVID-19, it is something that is really impairing their function on a day-to-day basis.
Mm.
In addition, there's also people who may not have had COVID-19, but they've been working remotely. They've been on screens, and screens are also a potential trigger for individuals having more frequent migraine attacks, and also maybe the isolation, the addition of not being out and socializing and exercising. Those things may have also contributed to worsening of underlying headache disorders that now are kind of being unmasked in the setting of the pandemic.
Yeah. You know, folks, by the way, if any of this sounds familiar to you, or if you suffer from severe headache disorder, definitely do hop on social media, Twitter or Facebook, and let us know about what your experiences are and your questions for Dr. Starling. And we'll also be hearing from a longtime headache researcher as well, who will join us in a minute here. So a panel of folks who are some of the best in answering questions about this widespread problem. And Dr. Starling, first of all, thank you for sharing your own personal experience with this. And if you don't mind, I usually don't like to actually talk about my health on the air, but it is familiar to me because, especially when you said the genetic component, I do have members of my family who have been severe migraine sufferers, and I wonderfully inherited the same. And like actually, given the age I'm in now, I think I might be outgrowing it, because that's what happened to the other member of my family who suffered from severe migraines for decades. Eventually, just age is what solved the problem for him. But we had the same symptoms. Like when I get hit with a migraine, first I get, the classic tunnel vision, photosensitivity, tightness around my head, nausea. And then I think like the distinguishing common symptom between me and my other family member is there's this bizarre sharp pain that feels like, the way I describe it to folks, is it feels like a railroad spike being pounded into my head from just like the top of my skull behind my right eye. And then it's as if the spike was coming out of underneath my right cheekbone. And until that resolves, it just like I really can't quite function. And fortunately, today it's, this barely happens to me anymore. But it is an experience that you just don't forget, the uniqueness of the sensations that are so different from when you just, brush off smaller headaches, but it feels distinctly different to me than when I have, like, say, I've been staring at the computer too long kind of headache. So is part of the problem here, Dr. Starling, in that we kind of often use the same term to describe really a wide variety of experiences?
Yes, it is. That is, I think, a part of the stigma of migraine, is that headache as a symptom is so common. And like you said, the headache that you can get just from being out in a bright area or being using screens or just being at a concert which was really loud, and you have like a minor headache. And because people have those symptoms frequently, there is a stigma and a minimization of what migraine is, which are, you know, you described it beautifully because when you described your experience, it's not just about the pain. It's not just about headache. And that's what's key. Migraine is not synonymous with a really bad headache. Migraine is a sensory processing disorder. And pain is one of those sensory inputs that's abnormally processed. But so is light and sound and motion. People get nauseous and vomit, and they have to curl up in a ball and not do anything until this experience gets to a tolerable level. But they still have other symptoms in this migraine hangover, or what scientists call a postdrome. After the pain phase is done, you just feel wiped out.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, now the comments are coming in, Dr. Starling. Adrian Brown says, I have suffered with migraine headaches before I could speak. Mine is strongly genetic because my mother suffered with debilitating migraine headaches. And Nina Max Daly is saying, Meghna, totally feel your description of a migraine. I have horrible chronic migraines more than 16 days per month, I presume, and have had incredible luck with Botox. Also have to plug the program, because her insurance is horrible. Oh, and the only way she can afford the Botox for migraine is because the company pays half my bill. So let's keep that one in mind, because we're going to talk about access to treatment in a minute here, Dr. Starling. But I want to get a sense to you from you about how we might understand if there's a disconnect between the widespread prevalence of the suffering versus how many experts like you are out there or the funding available to continue research here. Because there's, what, more than 40 million Americans living with migraine disorders. But how many board-certified, do we know, how many board-certified headache specialists like you are there?
There is less than 700 throughout the nation, and they're geographically like in the larger cities on the coasts. So many people, cannot even access a headache specialist if they wanted to. If you talk to any of my colleagues around the nation, we all have incredible wait lists of people trying to get in to see us because there's just so few of us. And a part of that is the stigma of migraine. I remember as a young neurology resident, when I decided I wanted to subspecialize in headache medicine, that I had people that I looked up to, mentors that I had through residency, that came to me and said, you know, oh, Amal, you're so smart. Why are you doing headache medicine? Why don't you do something more important or more hardcore neurology like Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease or multiple sclerosis? So even amongst the medical community, there is a stigma of migraine not being a legitimate neurologic disease.
I suppose one answer to their question is, colleagues, there are 40 million patients out there. I will never be out of a job. I mean, like, that's really interesting. That is absolutely fascinating. That's sort of like, this isn't hardcore science, right? Or hardcore neurological medicine here. Do you think that could be part of the picture about why it seems to be that there's a funding gap here, right? Because if you funded migraine research based on what we found is the National Institute of Health's own documentation of burden of disease, right? Migraine research should be funded at more than $200 million annually, but it gets a tenth of that, something like 19 to 24 million, right?
It is so crazy that they published that their own data. And it just shows that migraine is so underfunded and it is not at all aligned with the disease burden. And it all comes down to stigma. Stigma is such a large component as to why there is underfunding and less research. And when you have a biologic understanding that we're still building, if we had that understanding, it would legitimize the disease for many people. And so why do we have that stigma? Well, one of the things we mentioned is more common in women, mm-hmm. 3 times more common in women. So I think sexism plays a role here. It's also associated for many women with their menstrual cycle. So there's this, you know, perception of migraine affects weak, frail women that are just too emotional and they're just too stressed out. And I think that's a big contributing factor. I think the other thing, too, is that it is thus far an invisible disease.
Yeah.
There are no objective biomarkers. So there's this question in the back of some people's mind, whether it's the lay public or even maybe even some physicians, like, is it really real? And actually, even people who live with migraine, it's invisible because they hide it. They even sometimes will refuse the diagnosis and they unfortunately suffer in isolation. Mm. So there's this huge invisible component that adds to the stigma and also then adds to us not being able to advocate for increasing that funding. And we're trying to change that. And we've made some efforts recently, but there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. I will tell anyone listening now who doubts it that the feeling of a railroad spike being pounded with a 15-pound hammer into your brain is a real feeling. Again, we're getting here so many comments here. Here's Carly Cloyd, who says her daughter was diagnosed years ago as having migraines and never got any relief. She has since been diagnosed with daily persistent headache, which most likely came from an ear infection that went undiagnosed in middle school. Carly is saying it's relatively unknown, but do you think in the future there will be more studies on that ailment, Dr. Starling?
Yeah, so I think she's describing a disorder that's called new daily persistent headache. And in that headache disorder, there's like a date, there's an event that occurs, and someone did not have any headaches before then. And then after that, they've developed headache and often with other symptoms as well. And that's also a disorder that we know very little about, even less than migraine. It's likely going to be that there are a couple different diseases that result in that picture, that clinical picture. Like she described, sometimes it can be an infection that started it. And we were talking about the pandemic. Mm. I have been diagnosing some people with new daily persistent headache, which may have been triggered by a COVID-19 infection. But we're still learning a little bit more about that. There is active research, but we do need more. However, the research in migraine really does benefit all of the other headache disorders as well, because it often uses those final common pathways.
Okay. Well, Dr. Starling, hang on here for just a second. This has been remarkable thus far, but I want to bring into the conversation Dr. Peter Goadsby, joining us from Los Angeles. And Dr. Goadsby is president of the American Headache Society and a professor of neurology at the University of California, Los Angeles, and among the 4 winners of the 2021 Brain Prize for his work in identifying the role of a molecule called calcitonin gene-related peptide as a cause for migraine. Dr. Goadsby, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi.
So first of all, you've researched headaches for about 40 years now, if I have this correct. Can you first of all tell us what drew you to the field 2 generations ago to begin with?
Yeah, it seems like yesterday, but it's probably about that amount of time. Yeah. Time flies when you're having fun, it has to be said. What drew me to it? I think what drew me to it was good advice. I was well mentored, and picking up something that you were just talking about, it seemed to lack what you described as a hardcore science explanation for what was going on. If you would listen to what patients had to say, they clearly had a significant problem. And if you then looked at what was being offered as an explanation for the problem, it didn't seem sensible. And so I was, I became interested in trying to understand the problem. Mm. And can I just pick up something that you said in terms of the hardcore science? I think one of the problems, a problem that remains, is that we have made quite a lot of progress in the hardcore science. And like anything, you need to get that out. I don't think the progress, Liberty, we've made in the genetics and in the brain imaging side of things and now specific treatments. We do have hardcore science in migraine. It's just not got the... That hasn't had sufficient, how to say, publicity in the way that you're doing it now.
Yeah, you know, I have to say that far be it from me to say that scientists are free of prejudice, because in this case, to me, the very definition of hardcore science would be, look, there is something that people, millions and millions of people are suffering from that we don't fully understand. I mean, the scientifically curious mind would be like, that's a hardcore problem that we want to solve, right? So that's how I see what hardcore science is. It may not have, like you said, the headline drawing capacity of Alzheimer's or other things, but just my vote there for what constitutes real science. But Dr. Goadsby, we've got about a minute before our second break here. Can you just quickly describe to us, like, how much has our understanding of what are the drivers for these persistent disorders changed since you first entered the field?
Well, it's changed. It's unrecognizable. As Dr. Starling was saying, when I first entered the field, the view of the 30 to 40-year-old woman who had a headache when they menstruate, and it may change with pregnancy, and they're just a bit, they're sort of sad people in the suburbs, was quite pervasive. And I think amongst... certainly headache specialists, but amongst neurologists that's changing, because we've understood that there's some clear genetics, that we've understood that there's clear brain areas that are changing, which we can see on functional imaging. We've understood if we can define the biology, we can actually produce designer drugs, if you want, CGRP, calcitonin-generated peptide pathway blockers, which are effective in a way that's totally biologically yeah, predictable.
Dr. Goadsby, hang on here for just 1 second. And Dr. Starling, got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunio was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country, but it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to get back to the topic of today's show in just a quick second, but give me a moment here because I want to draw your attention over to the On Point podcast feed, because there you'll find a podcast-only special conversation featuring this woman.
I think in as far as the court has said that there is a penumbra that exists to encompass the entire purpose of the Constitution, that I think one of the purposes of the Constitution was to guarantee to the individual the right to determine the course of their own lives.
That is Sarah Weddington arguing before the Supreme Court in 1971 in Roe v. Wade. Weddington was the attorney who represented Jane Roe, and she was just 26 years old at the time she stood before the justices and won that landmark case. Now, Sarah Weddington died last year, but back in 2017, I interviewed her extensively, and she revealed the fascinating backstory of how she got involved in Roe v. Wade, about her own experience needing an abortion, and her concerns about the future of abortion rights in the U.S.
If you look at the Constitution, and even the Bible talks about when the first breath is taken, not when conception occurs. So I respect that there are some people who have that, you know, once conception occurs, that's it. But I still think it comes down to who gets to make that decision. And I just don't think it could be the government.
So that's from my 2017 interview with Sarah Weddington. And we put that interview as a special drop in our podcast feed. So take a listen to it and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And by the way, on Monday, we're going to talk about why the United States is moving in the opposite direction from much of the rest of the world when it comes to abortion. And we're going to focus on Latin America, where women have expanded abortion access in recent years, even as it's shrinking here in the United States. So that's on Monday. But let's get back to today, where we're talking about the widespread prevalence of severe headache disorders and how much we don't know about all the causes, all the presentations of these disorders, and there's still a long way to go to help the tens and hundreds of millions of people worldwide who suffer from them. I'm joined today by Dr. Amal J. Starling. She's an associate professor of neurology at the Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Peter Goadsby joins us as well, president of the American Headache Society. And I'd love to talk with both of you more about the key recent-ish discoveries that kind of unlocked a new era of headache science here. And Dr. Goadsby, let me just first turn to you. We've mentioned it by name, calcitonin gene-related peptide. What is it?
It's a chemical. It's what, 37 amino acids, so it's small. It circulates in the blood. It's released from nerves. It's important in the brain, among other things, in terms of being the chemical, the transmitter, the messenger that allows pain nerves in the head to talk to the brain.
Okay. So then, Dr. Starling, I appreciate your patience here. From your point of view, again, to explain to listeners out there, why was it so important? What did this discovery allow us to understand better?
Yeah, so what we learned in the research is that during a migraine attack, the level of this protein would increase. And also, when individuals were treated with migraine-specific medications for that attack, the level of the protein would go down. And then individuals with chronic migraine who have more than 15 headache days per month, so they have a more severe form of migraine, more frequent, they had chronically elevated amounts of this protein. So based on all this research with the foundation laid by Dr. Goadsby and others, there was the thought that if we could develop medications that were designed based on the mechanism of what we understand in migraine, there were medications that were designed to block or reduce or modulate the activity of this protein, that maybe that would be effective for the treatment of migraine. And also, we've had treatments for migraine, but these were things that we borrowed from other disease states. Treatment for migraine where we borrowed a medication from depression and anxiety or blood pressure or even a seizure disorder. And they were well studied in migraine with double-blind placebo-controlled trials and were effective, but they weren't initially designed with migraine in mind. So we always thought if we could find something, if we could learn about the biology of migraine, understand why migraine is happening in certain subsets of people, and design a medication based on that, maybe it'll be more effective and maybe it will have less side effects than those other medications. And that is what we did find in the clinical trials. And then also we've been using these medications in the clinic since 2018, since they first came out on the market. And it really has revolutionized the way we practice headache medicine and been so helpful for a subset of patients.
Okay, but if I have my dates here correctly, and Dr. Goadsby, let me turn back to you on this. It sounds like there was a long time between the discovery of CGRP and the breakthrough medicines that Dr. Starling just described. Is that right?
I'd say that's a long time is a generous description. Yes.
Meaning
it took from well, me.
It was decades.
Sorry, that was that was understatement, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, Lars Edvinson and I developed the CGRP hypothesis in 1990. That's when we showed, that's when we published that the CGRP was elevated in micronerves. So it did take a long time to get from there to current therapies. I mean, there are a few of difficulties along the way. The first of the medicines that were, firstly, there were people were interested in other things at the time. The work we were doing was not, people didn't really believe it, frankly. Eventually, there were medicines that were developed. The first of the ones that were developed turned out to have, when in the body, they were metabolized in the liver to something that caused liver problems. So the first couple of medicines died, and then the these antibodies came along, and newer second generation of the small molecule drugs came along. Drug development, firstly, you've got to have the idea, and then it's actually not that easy to get from A to B. A lot of things people forget, I think, all the difficulties there are in getting a medicine actually into people that works and is safe above pretty much anything else when you get started.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was just going to say that even under the best circumstances, drug development is a time-consuming process for good reasons. And, you know, getting a drug to market that's safe and effective, we do actually have to slow the process down, probably more than many people would like, but there are reasons for that. So I appreciate that point. But go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I think your listeners, I mean, ought to be happy that some of the early drugs died because the safety issues were identified. I mean, it shows listeners should be reassured that the process of watching what's going on actually works, and that things that are going to be difficult get stopped. It is a drag, but it's reassuring at another level.
Yeah. Well, as I keep saying, this is resonating with a lot of listeners here. Allison Logan sent us a message saying, migraines present as tension headaches in my back, neck, and my left temple. They last days or weeks. Allison was taking Excedrin and NSAIDs every day. She says, no doubt destroying my gut. Finally got relief with an old school blood pressure drug and has been headache free for 6 months. Corey J. says, have had migraines since about 19 years old. When it comes on in the right eye, it can be debilitating. It got worse at age 47. Corey was suffering from 1 to 2 times per month for 2 to 4 days. The only thing that works for Corey about 3/4 of the time is rizatriptan, or did I say that wrong?
Rizatriptan,
and then zolmitriptan. Did I say that?
That's right.
Okay. And are those drugs, are those the new class of drugs we've been talking about?
No, they're new in the history of migraine, which has been identified in human writings for a couple of thousand years. But the triptans were developed in the very late 1980s and first used in the early 1990s in the treatment, in the acute treatment of migraine to stop an attack. There's six of them.
Okay. Dr. Starling, Dr. Goadsby just briefly mentioned a word which in the past 2 years has become more familiar to Americans than I think we ever thought possible, because none of us had really heard of it before, but the monoclonal antibodies. I'll be honest, I was frankly surprised to see that outside the context of COVID treatment. But can you tell us a little bit about that and migraine or severe headaches?
Yes, I think that's a great question to talk about, because often people, and not just patients, but even healthcare professionals, were confused as to why would you use an antibody to treat migraine when migraine has nothing to do with the immune system. And what the monoclonal antibody is it's really a vehicle to deliver a medication to a specific place. So antibodies are very specific for another molecule, highly specific. And so they have genetically engineered monoclonal antibodies for many different diseases. And so as long as you have a drug target, like CGRP. Now, in migraine, as we learn more about the biology, we have identified other drug targets that we're currently studying. So the end is not CGRP. Monoclonal antibodies for CGRP is just the beginning in migraine. But the antibody is genetically engineered to not have an effect on the immune system, but rather directly takes this monoclonal antibody to the CGRP protein or the receptor that protein attaches to, and it modulates the activity of it. In this case, reduces the activity of it. And that's how it's potentially treating individuals with migraine.
Uh-huh.
Now, there's monoclonal antibodies for a lot of different diseases, and it's targeting different things that are responsible for those different diseases. And we aim to find other targets in migraine, and we'll develop monoclonal antibodies for those other targets to treat all the different individuals with migraine.
Interesting. Okay, so we've got a set of comments that keeps coming up over and over again. And so let me just read a couple of listeners' stories here. Aaron Brown says, my sister has had headaches for over a decade, so bad, complete with slurred speech and blackouts. She doesn't remember hours of her life. She's had two injections into her neck to try to stop them, but each time the relief lasted less than a year, and insurance fought tooth and nail against the procedure both times, and especially now that it's failed to provide lasting relief. And her sister lives with the pain daily and fears losing her job because of the nature of the symptoms. And then Alice says, so glad to hear Dr. Starling mention that especially for migraine disorder, headache is just one symptom of a whole body disorder. But Alice is also hoping to hear about the trouble affording and reaching treatments or getting treatments due to the cost and coverage issues around new anti-CGRP meds. So this keeps coming up because we're talking about healthcare in the U.S. context, of course. So Dr. Goadsby, first, your response to that about how insurance plays into people's access to care for migraines.
Yeah, well, you could take migraine and substitute just about any other medical condition you want to, and insurance plays into the care of slash whatever you want to say in medicine. It's a substantial problem, and part of the problem comes from the attitude to migraine, the stigmatized attitude to migraine that Dr. Starling was talking about. If you think a problem is enormously impactful and dreadful and holding society back, then and you saw value in treating that problem. And as I use those words, people listening are going to have different conditions in their mind. But I was thinking about migraine. But if you see a condition that way, then the pushback on paying for it is very different to the pushback of if you don't see it as a substantial problem. And so I think that this question of stigma plays into the problem of access very significantly. We don't, there's much less moaning from insurance companies, for example, about, it's hard to mention other conditions because I don't want to seem like I'm dissing anything else, so to speak. But there are plenty of conditions you could think of where these antibodies are done or where other things that cost 10 times as much are used and no one bats an eyelid because they think that's reasonable. So I think the insurance problem is for migraine is very much around the perception of the disease and also a lack of recognition of the fact that if she loses a job, that's a bad economic outcome. Yeah. Just put the person down for a second, because reduced economic activity is bad for the country altogether. And migraineurs are just perfectly placed. You make them well, and what they do is they work, they spend money, they go to the shops, they do the business, which turns the country over. Now, migraine affects people from the age of 18 to 65. You know, news bulletin. They're the taxpayers. Mm. So if you want society to function, then looking after people with migraine is in the interest of society, not to mention the sort of moral perspective.
Right, and one hopes that now that, you know, after decades of work by people like you, Dr. Goadsby, and Dr. Starling, that now that we have a better understanding, at least, or if we're further down the line in understanding the mechanism, right? So there's the quote-unquote hardcore science there, along with, as you said, you know, when we have tens of millions of people suffering from this, the measurable economic impact, maybe attitudes can change around people accessing treatment here. Now, we have 1 minute in a conversation that could have gone much longer. But Dr. Starling, I'm going to give you the last word here again, because this has resonated so powerfully with listeners. We always want to give people something that they can do, right? So what would you advise people who are currently dealing with headache disorders? What's a toolkit for them that we can give them in the last 30 seconds?
So many people, like your listeners that had feedback for us, have disengaged from the medical community because they've faced that stigma, because they weren't offered options. I always beg for people to re-engage with healthcare and come to your primary care provider, obtain a neurologist, find a headache specialist, because we do have options available for people now that we didn't before. So we can treat people who are living with migraine.
And for potential future generation of healthcare providers, seems like there's a market in need of more headache specialists. So Dr. Amal Starling, Associate Professor of Neurology at the Mayo Clinic, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Dr. Peter Goadsby, President of the American Headache Society and amongst the winners of the 2021 Brain Prize. Dr. Goadsby, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.